Hello and welcome to this week's episode of the Prep Kitchen Podcast, the podcast where Matt and I talk all things food, cookery and hospitality. Please don't forget to like, rate and subscribe to never miss an episode.
Chief, we're back.
We are back.
We are. We're really excited for today.
It's a special one.
It's a special one. We've got a special guest joining us today, Asma Khan. So I'm going to give you a little bit of a bio. If you're a Netflix person or a Chef's Table person, you will know who this is. Asma Khan is the chef and owner of Darjeeling Express. She moved to Cambridge from Calcutta in 1991. Now residing in London with her husband and two boys. She comes from a royal background, Kajput on her father's side and Bengali on her mother's. After studying law, Khan went on to do a PhD in British constitutional law at King's College London. Cooking was always her passion, and she began her food career in 2012 as a supper club in her home. In 2015, she opened a pop-up in a Soho pub to much acclaim, and Darjeeling Express, the restaurant, opened its doors in June 2017. A year later, her debut cookbook, Asma's Indian Kitchen, was published by Pavilion in October 2018. The book was the winner in the UK category for food publishing in Indian cuisine in the Gourmand World Cookbook Awards. Khan is the first British chef to feature in Netflix's Emmy-nominated Chef's Table. Her episode also received a 2020 James Beard Award nomination. Business Insider named her number one on their list of 100 coolest people in food and drink. The Evening Standard listed her in the Progress 1000 as one of London's most influential people 2019. She's been included in the 8th edition of the GG2 Power List, profiling Britain's 101 most influential Asians, and she is now the first chef to be featured on Vogue's list of 25 influential women of the year 2020. In 2021, Khan was shortlisted by GQ Food and Drink Awards in the Vive Clickout Innovator category.
Wow.
Wow. Ladies and gentlemen, Asma Khan.
Asma Khan.
Asma, thank you very much for coming onto the podcast.
I'm very happy to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
That's our pleasure. How are you?
I'm okay considering everything that's happening in London and all the insecurities. I'm actually doing really well.
Fantastic. And you've just opened a new Darjeeling last year. Is that right?
Yes. We moved from Soho to Covent Garden in the middle of the pandemic. And not, of course, knowing what was going to happen, we ended up only trading for 8 days.
Wow.
We couldn't open on the day that we were scheduled to open because that was that brief November lockdown. And we were all geared up, fully staffed to have our first proper Christmas. And then we were shut down. And we're still shut down. And we are getting ready to open in May. I don't have that much outside space, so we're not doing anything in April. It doesn't make sense for us.
What was the what was the main sort of motivation behind the move? Was it just a natural expansion of the business itself? You just needed more space because you had so much demand, or was it an opportunity that came up and you just had to jump at it?
No, actually, I didn't really fully understand what was going to happen after Net Chef's Table, because being the first British chef featured, there was no one you could ask, what happened. And I had, Gagan, who was featured in Chef's Table, based in Bangkok, calling me throughout saying, you're going to be inundated. Gagan is such a drama queen. He comes from my city. He comes from Calcutta. I know these men. I mean, if there's a small crisis, they're going to make like the world is going to fall apart. It's very, very kind of, dramatic calls, middle of the night saying, you're going to really struggle and you're going to... He told me that, when I got a Michelin star, I wasn't as busy as when I was on Chef's Table. And I thought, really? I mean, this guy's exaggerating like hell. But he was right. We really were ramped. It was very, very difficult. We had an only 55-seater restaurant. And, you know, when you say 55-seater, you don't mean that every seat is taken, because, you know, a table for four may have three people on it.
Yeah, yeah.
A table for two might have one person. So we were ending up doing 200 covers a day and turning tables around for lunch, you know, doing 95 to 100 people for lunch.
Wow.
And it was absolutely crazy. I realized very quickly it was not the fact that we were struggling to serve people. Everyone was extremely understanding. And, you know, we managed somehow, I don't even know how, to do 200 covers a night, a day. But the thing is that it was the size of the kitchen. We had no storage. I didn't ever imagine ever that I would have to do these kind of numbers, not even half this. I set up a restaurant to do quarter these numbers, you know, a service. I was going to do 55 covers, you know, for dinner and, you know, maybe 20 for lunch.
Sure.
It didn't turn out that way. And so I was trying to move out, but I had a really hard time. I could not find any landlord willing to show me anything. Everyone would tell me that I wasn't the right fit for places when I heard that certain places were available. Very disheartening and very, very unexpected, because by that time, I could show them bookings for a year in advance.
Wow.
I had paid my taxes. I had financials. I wasn't just some concept from Dubai that was turning up.
No.
I actually had run a restaurant, and I, you know, had enough information if people had any financial concerns, but clearly the concerns were not financial.
When you say not the right fit, does that more relate to the type of cuisine that you offer, or does it go a little bit deeper than that, you believe?
I'm not sure.
No.
I'm not sure, because the thing is that, you know, I will walk, because, you know, I don't have to go and battle, you know, with every person who I think is being unfair.
Sure.
You know, you don't need to go to every fight that you're invited to. And I wasn't going to, I knew that there was nothing to be gained from making a principal stand and making the point that, you know, I felt I was being discriminated against. But when it is so, you know, layered and nuanced and not direct, you know, if you tell me that, if I approached you and I said that I really would love to be on your podcast, and you tell me, you know, at this point, you know, because of the people that we have, you know, you don't fit in right now, we'll get back to you. What am I going to argue with you about? That I think that I felt that you were othering me. I felt that you were marginalizing me. Or do I turn around and say, no, you're going to tell me the list of people. So it's not worth my while. I lost respect for you. So I walk. So that's what happened. You know, I tried. And then I kept getting knocked back, and even to the extent where I was promised something and then someone scuppered my deal because they didn't want me there in their backyard. It was all very strange. And you know, coming from the East, you know, seeped in patriarchy, feudalism, misogyny, and where a woman is seen as less worthy than a man, and there's no, in business especially, no one would ever consider a woman working on her own as a safe pair of hands. I was surprised to find the same attitudes in this country.
Yeah.
This is not so different. Not so different.
No. In fact,
it's worse, because they don't tell you this on your face. I'd rather someone had the gall.
Yeah.
Gall and the guts to tell me on my face that not you, we don't want you.
I was going to relate.
Giving me these kind of reasons.
Yeah, I was going to relate back to the, obviously your story, it goes into some detail on the Netflix special that you did, and you obviously talk really candidly and really openly about, you know, the culture with which you come from and the attitudes towards women in general, but in particular the situation you're in being the second born female in the family. I was just wondering if that's ever something over the years you've been able to perhaps reconcile with, or does it still hurt you on the inside to know that culturally that's just the way it is, or is it something that you've, you know, sort of made peace with in some strange way, if possible?
No, I made peace. I made peace with it, because the thing is that my mother made amends very quickly. And I was only 3 and a half, but, you know, my brother was born. and she never celebrated his birth, which is very unusual from the kind of royal family I come from, where an heir, apparent heir has been, you know, is born. There is a huge amount of celebration, and she didn't do it. And I remember standing on the door of the house and people coming and telling me, did you have a daughter? Did she have a daughter? Do you have a sister? And I said, no, I have a brother. You know, a brother with my, there was a boy born in the house. And they said, no, it's not true. Because, you know, this is, you lament girls, you know, we got no sweets. And at that time I realized something happened. I knew I was equal. So I made peace with my mother then. This is the only person I needed to make peace with, my own mother. Yeah. After that, I did face difficulties with other people, but they were other people. Yeah. They're not my own blood. And this also allowed me to find a way to give myself the courage to know that my life mattered too, that I mattered. And I think that that changed things a lot. My mother was one of five daughters herself.
Wow.
But she lives in a society where I kept asking her, did you not ever feel that your birth was lamented? She said, I don't want to talk about it. She really? Was dark-skinned, very dark-skinned compared to her sisters. And I think that problem in our society is that it's the matriarchs who support the patriarchy.
Yeah.
It's the, you know, they, the mother, the mother-in-law, the grandmother, turn around and say, you know, a second-born girl, great, we have another girl in the family. Things would change.
Of course.
But where there is no oppression, where there's so much oppression, that you cannot actually call it out. This was why I had to say it in Netflix. It was not easy.
Oh,
it was not easy,
it was.
And I knew it was a very big platform. And I said it without asking my mother's permission. It was very difficult because I knew she didn't know it. And she only saw it first on screen when she saw it for the first time. And I was so terrified when she was watching it. Those 45 minutes that she was watching it, I was sitting weeping in one corner in fear because I knew that I hope she doesn't see this as a betrayal. She didn't.
Yeah. No.
She didn't at all. No. She had much issues about the film. Yeah. She told me, oh, your hair looked terrible. And, you know, why didn't you comb your hair? And, you know, you didn't iron your clothes. And, you know, what were all these Americans doing with you? You know, so many of these guys, nobody could fix their clothes. And I was thinking, wow. Okay.
Yeah.
You know, yeah, she thought my hair looked awful in the entire thing. She's probably right. But yeah, so she had issues, hair issues, but hair not issues. With what I'd said.
It is a very emotional episode of the Chef's Table, I suppose, because it's so far removed from what we're used to in this culture. To see something like that, you're like, this is craziness. But growing up in that must be, you know, second nature, I suppose.
It's not, because the thing is that, you know, you do pick up that this, I don't know, I had a very strong sense that this was very wrong. I wasn't willing to accept that I was second class. I wasn't willing to accept, you know, that I didn't count. And I used to hear my neighbors and people talking things like, you know, oh, when you have daughters, it's like watering your neighbor's garden because they're not really yours. They'll get married. You'll have to give them dowry and they'll leave. This is normal conversation, completely. Yeah. And, you know, people seeing my father with my sister and me would say, ah, you know, when is your family going to be complete? As if I completed nothing. As if the completion, a family only became a complete unit when the boy arrived. And it used to bother me a huge amount. Essentially, being a second daughter, you were treated differently by a lot of people. I, in my immediate family, was not treated differently. My brother and I were treated equally. And I know, probably, I hope my siblings are not going to listen to this podcast. I think I'm my mother's favorite and my father's. And
they
really loved me. They really loved me and made me feel that that I mattered. I think if I hadn't had that to hang on to go back to, I think I would have been a very different person. I would not have been this. I think the fact that my mother always made me feel that I mattered, and my father kept telling me, you know, go do something great with your life. I had that dream inside that I wanted the world to know my name. I wanted everyone to acknowledge my existence. This was not to do with my immediate family, who were very, very loving to me. But yeah. because it was a schizophrenic existence where in my house, in my own household, I was very important. But when I stepped out, being dark-skinned, overweight, you know, not attractive in the conventional sense of my very beautiful sister and cousins, who all look like dolls, you know, beautiful, beautiful, graceful women. My sister still looks 10 years younger than me. And this comparison, oh, don't go out in the sun, no one's going to marry you. You're so dark. You know, what's going to happen to you? We'll never find your boy. All of these comments that were thrown at me, I would come back and then my mother would tell me, oh, you're so gorgeous and you did so well. And, you know, even if I got into a fight, my father would always tell me, did you win? Not what happened to the fight. Later on, he would try and tell me, oh, it's not good to go and fight with boys. You know, don't hit people with cricket bats. In fact, this cricket bat incident is so bad. I met someone years later. He walked up and he said, do you not recognize me? This is in a very posh party. I said, no. He told me, you're the person, you hit me with a cricket bat. I was like, oh, wow. Oh no. And it just, they never, you know, it's not that they, you know, approved of everything I was doing. I would often get into trouble. I got punished quite a lot. In fact, I got punished quite a lot, you know, but it still allowed me to dream, to be powerful. And it's not that the scars don't go away. Even today, I feel the scars. But it is from here that the fire comes to succeed. Yeah. But not that I break my own chains, which I have. I need to break the chains of other women because my victory means nothing. My success means nothing if I do not free others. In liberating them, I am free. My power comes from who I've helped. And I think as a very young child, it mattered to me a lot. I used to get into huge trouble because I would release birds from my neighbor's house. It just would stress me out to see birds in cages. And my father would, you know, be called and they would tell your daughter is completely, you know, she's a, you know, wild kid. She came and our birds are worth so much. My father would lecture me in front of them and say, this is very wrong. Of course, we will send the money, you know, with the driver to pay for it. And then when we were walking back home, Abba used to hold my hand and say, well done. Always, always set them free. Cages are not for animals and not for human beings. And I used to feel so important because everybody thought I was in shit, but I wasn't. Because my father told me the right thing to do. Set the birds free. And it's just that whatever happened outside, inside your house, they made you feel like the most powerful person. I couldn't be this. I couldn't have come this far if I didn't have that. The kind of affirmation of family, of friends, is very important, is a game changer. And it's only because I realized what it did to me that I made a huge effort to help my team of women who came from extremely deprived, abused, and violent relationships, who went through life thinking they didn't count. Today, look at them. They are just powerhouses. I stand on their shoulders. And that transformation, I know, is possible. So it should be beyond lip service, you know, that let's try and empower women. You know when you have. You see it in the eyes of that other person. You see it in the way they walk. You see it in the actions, in what they do. They don't need to come and tell you, I feel empowered. You know it.
Yeah.
You see it in their eyes. And this is a really thing that I get greatest joy from. Not from every other success. You know, yes, it's very nice. I'm very grateful for the restaurant, for Netflix, for all the accolades I've got. It's very nice. But nothing beats that when you see someone who you know was in a very dark place and you help them free. Just like the birds, you know, letting them off the cages. Seeing them fly. Oh, that was such an incredible feeling. And I knew after this, I'd get into huge trouble. There'd be lots of shouting and my neighbor would be chasing me and I'm running till they caught me and dragged me to the house. All this was to happen. But no, that bird should not have been there and I wasn't going to let it be there. So, yeah. So this is what a second order is. It's many layers. It's not just that, you know, you were discriminated against and people were really horrible to you and people lamented your birth and all of this. All of that is true as well. But people also let you be and let you free. And I realized that I'm not chained. I'm not I don't have to conform to anything. And the fact that I got married relatively late to not someone who was not royal, because everybody else had to, because of, I don't know, family tradition. No one in my class wanted to marry me. I ended up marrying an academic, very left-wing academic, teaching at Cambridge. This is very unconventional. You know, in my family, you marry your second, third cousin removed, who's also royalty, and, you know, whatever, you, their family can be traced back to Genghis Khan. You know, it's all of that. But, you know, I married someone who's just an academic, and everyone was just so relieved. I mean, my entire wedding day, I remember aunts coming and saying, I'm in tears, I can't believe you're finally getting married. I was thinking, can someone just say something else to me? It's not the same thing.
Yeah.
They kept coming and telling me the same thing. Yeah, so it's very weird. Discrimination works in a really strange, subtle way. But, you know, some stuff you are, is so painful that it pierces through. The others I won't allow. I wouldn't allow it to hurt me.
When you say about the women that you have working with you in your team at the restaurant, how many are we talking? Because obviously with a bigger operation, you're going to need to staff more considerably. So how many women do you currently have in your team there at the kitchen?
So at the moment, we're running a very kind of small outfit.
Of course.
And, you know, the rest have been furloughed. And actually, I have a very big team. Hmm. Many of them are mothers. And so they work part-time.
Yeah.
And their children have grown up. And, you know, and they're able to now work full-time. So it's still very much the same team. You know, we can now have everybody on board. And unfortunately, because of lockdown, many of them are still not coming back to work. But they will, and we'll have enough. And if we have to expand, we'll expand. Mm. So we have, interestingly, for the deli, you know, because we're running the deli as a takeaway, we've taken on three Indian students. So very young, you know, they're all doing culinary history and culinary something. And in over here, they've come to study, and one lives here. And it's nice because they're very different age group. And we feel this is a good mix. You know, we have a much older average age 50 in the kitchen. Mm. We have average age 20 in the front of house, you know, girls of Indian origin working with us. And we also have, you know, we've hired men, and, you know, my GM is French, and he's, and my personal assistant is American, and he's, you know, not, comes from a restaurant background, you know, comes from a military background, mm-hmm. US military background. And, but it's, we try to be, have a mix of everything. So my criticism of so many restaurants is that, you know, there's a lot of selection, self-selection, white people select white people in positions of power. Yeah. And, you know, this is a huge issue. You will never find people who look like me higher up in the executive order in any restaurant. You will never find anyone who looks like me, who's black, at the reception of a posh restaurant. Everybody looks the same.
Do you think that's a conscious decision? Kitchen,
I don't know. But when you go into the kitchen and you look at who's washing the pots, every KP looks the same as well. He's invariably black. So, I don't know. I'm just asking the question.
Sure.
I want to know how this categorization and banding of people has happened. It's interesting. Yeah. I mean, if you think that, you know, there's a look of who you want at your reception in a very posh restaurant, but that's not the kind of look I fit into, say it openly.
Yeah.
But they don't.
It is interesting, so, isn't it? Because it's those things that you see and you just... I don't know. Like you say, you walk around a kitchen or whatever, or you walk into a hotel or restaurant and you see the person on the front, you see the person behind the line, you see the person in the pots, and you don't really compute anything other than, oh, that's their job. You know, you don't, like you say, you don't delve deeper into it and ask, well, how come?
And the thing is that this is normal, you know. Most people will just look at it very superficially because this is the norm. And I'm very fortunate not to be part of the system. I'm at the fringes of hospitality.
Sure.
I owe allegiance to no one. Mm. No one has helped me. I don't have a godfather. I don't owe any male chef my allegiance because he helped me out in my early days. This is why so many female chefs who got Michelin stars are silent. Whenever there are evidence of misogyny and bullying, please check. You will not find a single statement from a female who has a Michelin star. I want to know why. They closed ranks with the male chefs because for them, this is about solidarity and, you know, and their connections. Not one. And, you know, the recent comments by a very prominent white chef about the liability of having a pregnant woman, and this is why they want pregnant women in their restaurant. I was the only one who wrote a one full page article in the newspaper. Mm. Absolutely so livid.
Yeah.
But there wasn't a comment from anyone else who was a female chef, who was a position of power. How is it that you see yourself not as a female leader? It is very important, because even if you don't see yourself as a leader and see yourself as a highly gifted chef of unspecified gender, the women working under you see you as a female. Women working under you know this. Your silence means everything. Silence means collusion with the oppressor. Yeah. Sure. This has been said in history throughout. And I just feel that, you know, part of what I want to do is also speak for the voiceless, those who are not without power and authority. I go back to being a second daughter again. The feeling that I'm being sidelined and sneered at and dismissed, my dark skin, my unattractive face, the fact that no one would marry me, that, you know, my poor father would have to find a boy for me.
Hmm.
I've come from that to this, where I see the same thing happening without the actual open comments.
Sure.
That I don't want to have a woman in my kitchen. I'd rather have a macho guy, because actually we're not running a kitchen. We're in Mortal Kombat. We're going to be like doing 16-hour shifts. We're going to smash it. We're going to be like working all night, and she's not strong. Any guy wants to have a... Anyway, I grew up as a tomboy, so yeah.
Yeah.
I could do the Mortal Kombat bit too. But this is not... You're not at war. You are serving people. And there too was linked to my industry, which is being hospitable and service. I don't see anything that's not an endurance test. I'm not trying to be G.I. Joe.
No.
This is the problem, that there is the link is all to do with physical prowess and fitness and ability to do these long shifts. I think it's so harmful to men. I worry for them, because you go out when it's dark, you come home when it's dark, your social life is completely messed up. It is a struggle, but it is seen as, you know, you've got to suck it up and be macho. This is not just a problem for women. It's a problem for men too. You know, and this is why in any other place, and I'm saying this as a lawyer, if there was touching without consent outside the kitchen by a male chef to a female, he'd be in prison.
Mm.
In a kitchen, this is being allowed by owners of restaurants and the administration, that you physically attack a woman in a kitchen and your excuse that you're stressed. Get the hell out of the kitchen. You don't deserve to be there. You can't deal with the stress. And this is a problem. These are not conversations that are happening. You know, even a CEO of a big company, you know, attacks his, you know, assistant, you know, because he's stressed out. The kind of shareholders will get rid of him, because you can't, you know. Finally, that point has come where you cannot keep people on who are like this, who are a liability. But not a single male chef is being reprimanded. Not a single male chef, except the recent, you know, what happened with Dan Doherty. And I can say it because I wrote an article and he didn't sue me, so it's fine. You know, he got away with, you know, he had to eventually leave when it became too much. But, you know, why is it this way? I feel that, you know, feudalism of the East, you know, the kind of dismissing of women in the East, it actually happens here. Just that you guys don't see it.
No, it's like you say, it's the discriminatory nature of things is slightly more, it's just nuanced in a way, because it's not in your face, like you said, where you're from. People will just say X, Y, Z straight to your face. Whereas here, it's underhanded. I mean, things of that nature, things that can be, I don't know, pernicious forms of behavior, they find ways to integrate into the society in a way in which they're not as noticeable. You know, racism still exists, but it's had to put a different hat on, so it's not as obvious. And the same with sexual discrimination and all things of that nature. One thing I wanted to get your opinion on, Asma, was you mentioned, or it's mentioned in the Netflix special, but obviously you've spoken about it as well, about coming to the UK and it sort of dawned on you that you didn't know how to cook, but you missed the flavors of home so badly, you just had to go back and you just had to learn. And when you went back and you were spending time learning about all these dishes and the food culture and heritage of where you're from, did it in any way make you see your home in a different way from when you were there previously? If yes. That makes any sense.
No, it's a very good question. And no one else has asked me this before. Because, you know, I took it for granted till I left. I had an arranged marriage. So literally within 3 months of meeting my husband, I got married and left. So, you know, everything was like crazy confusion, you know, trying to get, you know, organize my wedding for 5,000 people. And it was like complete madness. And so I didn't even realize what I was leaving. And I always took food and the abundance of food and the kind of my mother's presence and her feeding me for granted. So when I went back, those months of isolation, of living in a very cold Cambridge, I came back looking at life differently. And, you know, no one's asked me this question, but I remember feeling suddenly extremely emotional when the first meal was served to me on my dining table. My father had never let anyone else sit on the chair where I would sit after I got married. That chair was always left empty. And my father was dusted the chair and said, you know, take your seat. I wept because it was the realization that, you know, I sat here so many times. I had so many meals. And I got up without being grateful for what I had. And I realized how important it was to honor not just my mother, but the cooks in the kitchen, the hands that cooked, that we never saw, that I never acknowledged, that I never recognized. This was what drove me to Darjeeling Express. So it was actually very, very unusual, you know, reaction when I went home, because I suddenly was standing apart from this normal family life. And I was now an outsider. I had an outsider's view of what it was actually that was so valuable about my family home and my food.
Wonderful. Now, I know, Paul, you've got a few questions, so I'll let you get a word in edgeways now, mate.
Thank you. I didn't stick with the Netflix program. I've been engrossed in asthma for a week. You said on a podcast you only use British ingredients for the restaurant.
Yeah.
Has that impacted any way in which you write menus? And have you had to make sacrifices in things you put on menus so you can keep going with the British thing instead of importing?
I've had to make small adjustments, you know, where we have something called turai, which is like, it looks like a courgette, has the same texture as courgette. So I've had substituted vegetables of the same texture that you got in the East that you don't get here, but I've substituted them with, you know, British courgettes and, you know, a particular kind of very thick beans that I have actually used asparagus, British asparagus during the season, and used that in a very traditional dish where, you know, the beans are just quickly cooked. And, you know, I've used broad beans and I've used, you know, asparagus, and I've just replaced that beans. I've never had to compromise because I now sit and I look at what is in season, what is, you know, and I walk around the markets and I see all the stuff that is heavily discounted, British stuff that, you know, there's a glut, you know. I'm an Indian housewife, so this is one thing you always know. In the bazaar, my mother would always roam around and say, you know, keep an eye out and see what there's a glut of. You know, buy stuff in peak season. It's very fresh, but the price will be low because they need to get rid of it. You know, there's everything is out there. So, of course, that's, you know, 30 years ago. Now we have refrigeration, you know, cold storage. We even have supermarkets. So, you know, people now can get anything. You don't have that insecurity anymore. So even my mother bargaining with the bazaar, you know, the seller of the vegetables, you know, she knew he needed to get rid of it. And it was just crazy. But this is something, of course, you know, because we are so racist. You know, we resent the British for everything. But we've forgotten to be grateful to the British for having got so many amazing vegetables to our country. Cauliflower, potatoes, all thanks to the British. The Portuguese got so much fabulous stuff. Everyone hates the Portuguese. Mm-hmm. Oh, the foreigners came and invaded us. Yes, but they planted all this amazing stuff. in India. So, you know, it is interesting that, you know, cauliflower, alu matar gobi, which is like classic Indian. You ask an Indian, you know, the British got the potato and the gobi, they're going to fight with you like hell. The British did nothing. They built the railways, they taught us how to go to school, and that's it. They did nothing. It's really crazy. The lack of understanding of the contribution of others to our cuisine is incredible. So I'm actually not, but because I understand, you know, I'm very into food history, I understand, you know, that so much of our stuff, you know, beetroot, aubergine, you know, how we're using these different kinds of things is to do with other bits, even tamarind, you know. Tamarind is such an important part of our thing. It's, you know, came from Africa. And a lot of us, you know, chickpeas came from Egypt. You know, we didn't have chickpeas. Chana masala is our great dish. But really, is it really ours? You know? So I'm very comfortable using only British ingredients. And I think it's very important because from the flip side, you know, my father's a farmer. Farmers are being, and you know, there was recent, there's a huge farmers protest going on in India.
Farmers have paid
a very high price. There's no trickle-down effect. The middleman makes the money. The farmer makes no money. They are buying genetically modified seeds. They're growing stuff for the Western market. When they bring their stuff to the market, the middleman will negotiate saying your okra is a little bit too small. But that okra is not enough to feed his family. They're buying. They basically will buy at a dirt price because they know that person doesn't have a choice. They cannot take this kind of grown for the foreign market food and sell it in an Indian bazaar. It's not going to sell. And this is, they've got a gun on their head. So they get the price they want. Their children are starving. They have a very high farmer suicide. I see blood of farmers on the plates of restaurants that are bringing in jackfruit and all kinds of other exotic ingredients. There's no water in the villages around my ancestral fortress because of excessive pumping of water for wheat. We should not be growing wheat. We should be growing millet because it is a very arid area. The desert is moving closer to us all the time. But because wheat is seen as a kind of, you know, high quality crop, they're growing that. So in reaction to all of that, I buy, you know, I buy everything British. I buy as much as I can local. British, you know, herbs are not great, the ones that I can use. So, you know, we buy stuff from Spain and Italy, go up to there. But I will not fly down stuff, you know, wrapped in plastic. It's a disgrace. The carbon footprint on so many Indian restaurants is so high. No one talks about it. Yeah. It's unacceptable. Why do you want to serve okra, fried okra? Do you know what's happening to the farmers who are growing this? And it's very controversial. I have to be very careful when I go back to India to talk about this because my father's a farmer and the, you know, fertilizer mafia is very powerful. You've got to be careful.
The fertilizer mafia, they sound deadly.
So sort of going on from that, your tasting menu at the new Darjeeling is being offered at a premium price. You were quite vocal about this and I just wanted to sort of get your take on here. Regarding that, sort of, you'd go to a European restaurant and you'd be happy to pay £95-£100 for a tasting menu, but you'd go to an Asian restaurant and you wouldn't. Is that what you were getting at?
Yes. And the thing is that, you know, when we reopen, we're not reopening with a tasting menu because at the moment, I'm personally a bit worried how it's going to be. So, you know, I'm not willing to kind of invest in that kind of staffing. And we're having a much more smaller, muted opening. But yes, that was why I had that. Ethnic food is always seen as cheap and cheerful. It smacks of racism.
Yeah.
So even among Asian food, you'll find Japanese and Korean food is seen more elevated than Indian and Pakistani and Sri Lankan food. And this, again, is to do with the attitude towards our food by people who think this is a food that is made with no skills. The fault lies with the people who set up Indian restaurants here who never explain their food very well. And this current crop of Michelin star Indian restaurants, and a lot of them are my friends, and I want to apologize. I like you all, but I want to criticize what you guys do, which is that they don't communicate. They don't tell the stories. They don't bring honor back to the hands that cooked, to their mothers and grandmothers. There's one reason, because they never learned from them. They've all learned in culinary school. All the male chefs who have become something in the West all went to similar culinary schools. They all went to say 5-star hotels for training. Their food is all the same. They went through a production line training of how to cook. This is why their menu looks like the size of my table. Because how else can you do it? We don't have fridges in our houses. You know, in Calcutta, it's 40 degrees, 100% humidity. What food can you keep? You can't cook in advance. You don't separate sauces and meat. My God, you do not. You don't try and make your food look French because it just looks prettier. Our food is not that attractive. But then when you taste it, you taste the layers and the depth of spices.
That's what when you earlier mentioned about how particularly Japanese cuisine, it seems that people have a sort of mistakenly seen presentation and aesthetics as a sign of sophistication, when sophistication within cookery, like you just said, comes within the layers of the flavor and the understanding of, you know, really working and using the ingredients that you've got. Sophistication in terms of cookery is all surely just technique and skill. It's nothing to do with how it looks on the plate. That's just aesthetic. So how Japanese cuisine and Korean food seems to be elevated, but as you say, Indian and Pakistani cuisine doesn't seem to, you know, it obviously doesn't have that same presentational aspect, and therefore it's kind of just disregarded as a sophisticated form of cookery.
Yeah, it's to do with that, you know. And the thing is that if this is all that we've reduced ourselves to, that, you know, it is food to impress, but not food to heal. It is not food to comfort. It is not food that has stories and memories. It's unfortunate because as a chef, this is why I cook. I don't cook to impress you. I don't want to put edible flowers and micro herbs and try and hide the brown sauce under it. Because that takes away the honor of my food. And the problem is that Indian Pakistani food is seen as not attractive. And to make it attractive, chefs have done terrible things to it.
Yeah. Does it annoy you to see Eastern chefs sort of Easternizing Western dishes? Does that make sense, or am I talking rubbish?
Yeah, no, it does bother me. But, you know, it's like, you know, standing there and fighting the tide. This is what people think is the way to be sophisticated, is to merge kinds of, you know, Indian, you know, something with, you know, other cuisines. And I hate the word where people talk about, you know, Indian tapas style. Why are you using other, you know, food of other cultures to describe your own food? Are you so confused that you don't know what your food is supposed to be called? This idea of eating small plates, my God, my grandmother would slap anyone who would turn up with a small plate or something. It's really wrong. It's not in our culture. We don't go and give a small tiji put of food and say, you eat this without rice and you eat this without bread. Someone will faint in my family if you do that. So don't try. Don't dishonor the tradition of our food. I have nothing against you trying to be innovative, coming up with great ideas, you know. Go and, you know, I've seen someone recently, I will not name him, presenting a samosa that looks like a spring roll. But please, samosa has a particular kind of shape. At least keep to the shape. Don't call it a samosa and present a spring roll. It is just staggering. And if I told you, I'm going to give you toad in a hole and present you with a, you know, a spinach salad, and say, this is my twist on it. I mean, who is stupid? And the problem is that no one is doing this to other people's food, but they're doing it to my food. Why are you taking my food and playing around with it? At least be respectful. Try and keep the soul of the food. Of course, you can innovate. I have two children. One of them cooks. He does hideous combinations. He takes my paratha and puts all kinds of horrible things in it. I fight with him. He's another generation, you know. But in the end, whatever he cooks tastes Indian, tastes, has the soul. Yeah. He doesn't try to camouflage it. No. I mean, it's weird, the food he makes. And I just keep telling him it's really weird. In my cookbook, the last chapter is going to be some of his weird food that I cook because he loves it so much. You know, I have to accept, you know, you've got to change. You know, change is inevitable. Yeah. But to throw away the baby with the bathwater, that is my problem. That when you're trying to change something, you throw away the very heart of your cuisine because it's not pretty. And coming from the story and the background and being a second daughter, and I can tell you one thing, to be sidelined because you're not the perfect one is wrong. And you do this to your own food because it doesn't fit in with what you think is Western aesthetics, shame on you.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah. I suppose there's a big difference between sort of evolving your cuisine, which is what your son does, and sort of just turning it into something that it's not with an Indian name.
You lose the essence of the nature of the dish, don't you? It's just lost.
Yeah, and the thing is that, you know, I think it's disrespectful. You know, I don't want to use the word cultural appropriation because I know this is very, very kind of loaded word to use. But you can't take, you know, when the majority, you know, community takes the food of a minority community, makes money from it, but doesn't give them the respect and the honor, you know, doesn't give them the jobs, doesn't give them any kind of benefit from their success using their ingredients and their name and their twist on a certain thing. It's wrong.
Yeah.
It's wrong.
I remember when Paul and I worked together and we used to have constant, shall we say, disagreements, to put it politely, with the management and the owners. And there was one occasion where they approached us and they said, we really want you to put a couple of curries on the menu and serve them on a Tuesday night. And I kept reminding them that I'm a postman's son from Cornwall. I don't know anything about, I mean, I can muddle my way through a curry, so to speak, you know, but what the hell do I know about it? And they just wouldn't have it. They were like, I'll just put a curry. I said, well, no, it's not my, I don't know what I'm doing, basically. But they wouldn't have it.
Yeah, but not everybody, you know, will make the point that you're making. I mean, during the lockdown, my kids were like, you know, can you make lasagna? I couldn't. I had to look at YouTube tutorials and I made it. You know, I'd never made lasagna before. I had no idea. But, you know, it's all right. Everyone should cook everyone's food. But when you're selling it for a commercial, you know, purpose, when it becomes... Yeah. You know, you also take away the space of the, you know, small curry house down the road. People will come to the pub and eat it and not to the, you know, curry house. You take away that opportunity because you're more bigger and you're powerful and you have a very nice space, which they don't. Yeah. They lose. So there are all these very nuanced layers of what happens when we lose out, when people take away our food and commercialize it and they take away our chances and our opportunities. Same like, you know, you see all these... Too many white men doing food programs in India. Oh my God. Can you not find anybody else instead of sending jaded, you know, people to do their, you know, oh, this is so exotic and this is so colorful. One more person says exotic and colorful, I'll kill myself. What is this? You know, I'm so fed up of seeing people coming and describing my cuisine and my country as colorful and exotic. I mean, why are you not talking to women who are cooking in, you know, in my country? It's a really weird kind of way to present another cuisine. Of course, you know, people should go and present programs on other cultures and cuisines, but at least, you know, broaden your horizon, broaden your vocabulary.
Yeah, perhaps it's the programs that you mentioned. They feel like they're giving you a peek behind the curtain into the culture, but in a sense, they're just, I suppose, perpetuating the issue by not really giving it the proper look that it deserves and not talking to the actual people and discussing the actual problems. You know, you can mask over anything, any place in the world that's got issues and problems, and you can just turn up and go to a couple of nice restaurants and go, it's amazing, everyone would love it. But it's not looking deep enough into actually what the culture is, good and bad.
Yeah, and the thing is that, you know, it's what's and all. You know, this is, you know, our cuisine is that, you know, on my tasting menu, I had dishes from my royal family, but I had the food that the street, you know, the chapulas eat. This is all they can afford to eat. I have that dish. And I explained that I cannot describe and present the food of the rich unless I first present the food of the poor. Yeah. But, you know, there's no shame in this. This is how it is. Our society is fractured and layered, and there's lots of divisions about who eats what food, what. There's no kind of understanding, and you know, everyone's scared, they don't want to kind of step on toes. Stepping on toes, I'm not worried about. I'll step on everyone's toes.
I didn't think you were.
Talking of stepping on toes, on the first episode of this podcast, we discussed a conversation between Gordon Ramsay and Rishi Sunak, and you were quite vocal about that at the time. I just wondered if you could explain to us your issue with that conversation.
It really shows the blinkered, you know, views of a government who, towards the end of absolutely a brutal year for hospitality, that the Chancellor thinks that the best person they can speak to is a chef who wasn't that supportive to his team when the lockdowns happened. And and his takeaway from this whole conversation was a great way to pivot out of the pandemic was to host a game show. Wow.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
This really upset me. And, you know, this is not that, you know, I don't like Gordon Ramsay or whatever. I don't have an opinion really on him. I don't waste my time thinking about him. But Rishi Sunak is my chancellor. He represents this country and all the aspirations of all the businesses that got impacted by the pandemic. This is my issue. Who did you pick to speak to? And did you actually think this was the right person to talk to? And unfortunately, over the pandemic, the voices that have been heard the most, the loudest voices, speaking on behalf of hospitality, have all very vested interest in pubs, in alcohol, in big chains. You know, you have, you know, an owner of a big chain saying, I don't care about the pandemic and the death. My business, I need to open. This is highly irresponsible. And these kind of comments are allowed. And how is it? You know, I have worked since the lockdown with Sadiq Khan's entire team. There's a kind of central London team. You know, talking to TfL, talking to people who are transport from London, but also tourism people, you know, London Eye, people who are really severely being impacted by the fact that we know tourists are not going to come back. Central London is very dependent on tourists, you know, for retail as well. I'm representing hospitality. I have learned a lot. I'm talking to people who are, you know, concerned about Oxford Street, you know, the pedestrianization. We discuss huge things about the business rates and how that impacts. This is helpful. And, you know, this is the mayor of London who's trying to speak to, you know, voices that are at the cold front. I am.
Yeah.
You know, I'm in central London in a giant space where I know at lunchtime, there are office people here. There are no tourists. I still need to pay my rent for lunch and dinner.
Yeah.
It's not that my landlord is going to turn around and say, as you only have people coming in for dinner, I won't take your lunch, you know, rent. No, that's not going to say that. I wish he did, but he's not going to say it. So we are all stuck. We have to pay over the top for delivery services, you know, from, you know, people. And when I'm here, nobody wants to take my job. They cancel. All the riders cancel my job. Because the closest, you know, destination where a big, you know, residential areas is 6 miles away. They don't want to ride 6 miles. They see the postcode and they cancel me. I have to use taxis to drop the food. These are my problems. Yeah. But am I going to be the head of a game show? No. This is not how I pivot. I pivot out of it by crawling through this absolutely brutal, horrible time. Every day I rock up to work. Every day I try to stay optimistic. I can look at my staff and because I know I'm paying them. We try to make each other safe. I secure my staff. You know, I'm just appalled that even now, I don't know who they're talking to. I haven't met a single person who Boris Johnson has talked to in hospitality. Mm-hmm. I haven't met anybody. Maybe you guys will find somebody who has. Or maybe they're too embarrassed to admit that they talked to him. I don't know. But, you know, it's incredible that, you know, no one I know has spoken to the government about anything. And why are they not talking to us? We want to talk to them. We need their cooperation. We need their help. This taxi has come. Does the taxi has come?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, because he's calling me. Sorry, yes.
Yeah, that's okay, yeah. We both sort of agreed that sort of interview was just a PR stunt for the game show. And actually, what we got out of it as chefs and as a restaurateur, I presume, that none of our issues were brought up that we needed answers to. It was just a PR stunt to say, you know, I've got a game show now.
Yeah.
No, but the thing is that, you know, it's so worrying that this is, you know, what is a priority for so many chefs. You know, people have secured their own personal fortune, you know. And they're not bad people. But, you know, when you have a £500,000 hole in your pension fund, you know, the taxpayers would pay that. And we should never have been in this situation. We should never have reached this position. And I think that being male, being, you know, a TV figure has allowed a lot of people to ride through and take a huge amount of risks that people like me could never afford to. Look at me. I couldn't get a space. No one gave me a restaurant, even though I had the financials. Yeah. There's a huge disparity. There's a two-speed hospitality system. Those that are very powerful. This is like an all-male Mayfair members club, of which I will never be a member. That members club will always get all the good things that are available. All of us who are on the fringes will stay on the fringes. But I'm not willing to die till you notice people like me. In my lifetime, I will see change. In my lifetime, I will be the heckler, the disruptor, you know, the activist on the side. This matters to me more than my business fortune and my personal fortune, of which I have nothing left because I have to put everything, I put everything to my restaurant. But I live with dignity. I live with honor.
Yeah.
That is more important.
Fantastic.
I would have loved to have seen an alternative interview with Rishi Sunak sitting down with you. I think that would have been it would have been a tough 20 minutes or so for him, I would imagine.
He's Asian, so he's used to this kind of. This is why he would never talk to someone like me. He knows exactly what he's going to
get. He knows what he's going to get.
He's going to get Indian auntie giving him one, two kind of lessons in life.
Yes.
Yeah.
He's not going to risk taking on an Indian auntie. No.
No chance. No chance. And also, secondly, if you were to host a game show, I'd watch it. I think it'd be quite funny.
Thank you. I know. As well. So next time I say, I have two potential,
Two viewers.
Please create a game show.
We'll come and work for you for free on the floor or something like that. You know, move some cameras around.
Who wants to be a millionaire? Yes,
that's it. Everybody apparently. what we're going to have to do is wrap it up, but we'll wrap it up with a couple of little foodie related questions. I know Paul's got one for you, and then I'll hit you with a couple, and then we'll depart.
I've got two actually.
You've got two. You fire away, mate.
I'm going to do this one first. Asma, I've got your book.
Yes.
And I'm going to be cooking tonight paneer curry.
Yes.
Do you have any tips for me?
Just soak the pan. If you're making the paneer, are you making it or are you buying the paneer?
I'm making it after we've done this.
Yes. So don't try and waste a lot of time trying to scrub the pan because the milk will get stuck. So just soak it. Soak it with a little bit of fairy liquid. It's really good because it's much easier to clean the next day. And the other thing is that, you know, it is really about, you know, my recipe is there, but play around with the balance of the tomato, you know, puree and the coconut to get the texture you like. Because it depends on whether you're eating it with rice or bread. You know, you don't have to follow my recipe and the balance. You know, just play around with it and see, you know, I like it this creamy, or I want it more dry. You know, that's my advice to you.
Yeah, my girlfriend Sam's vegetarian and she loves going through this.
Okay.
Because it's probably one of the only cookbooks that's got a decent amount of vegetarian recipes in there.
Yeah, and also my second book as well, I'm doing a lot of vegetarian recipes. In India, we eat a lot of vegetables. It's too hot. It's a very hot country.
Yeah, the second question is, what is your go-to comfort food?
It's carbs on carbs. I'm sad to admit. I love, you know, I have in the cookbook, I have got three paratha recipes. And they're all fabulous. Mm. I love them. And then lots of potato recipes. So for me, a hot paratha fried in ghee with potatoes. Yeah. British potatoes are so amazing. So amazing. And, you know, that's it. So potatoes and paratha.
Fantastic.
That sounds pretty good. Well, I was just going to get your insight into one little thing. On the podcast, on a weekly basis that we currently do it at, Paul and I challenge one another with a certain ingredient, and it obviously differs every week. We pull it out at random. And the most recent one we had come through was pistachios. Paul's already made his. I'm doing mine this evening. But if I was to challenge you to do something with pistachio, Asma, what would you knock up for us?
I would do pistachio barfi. It's very indulgent. It's, you know, you basically soak and grind down the, basically make it like a powdered almonds that you see on in thing. So very indulgent because that's kind of thing. And then you cook it with ghee and sugar and you make it like a thick fudge and you set it on a tray and then you cut it into shapes. And it is like the best thing possible. And it is something that, you know, you can't go wrong on. And so it's, pistachios are expensive. So this is a kind of really indulgent dessert to make. And, you know, I would make, if I had some amount of pistachio, I would make pista parfait.
I need the recipe for that.
Need the recipe for that one, yeah. that's not in the book, no?
No, no, that's not in the book. It's going to be in the other book.
Oh, well.
Oh, fine.
We'll get the next one then. We'll get the
next
one.
Just for that one.
Just for that one. We'll make it. Well, that brings us to an end. We're sadly running out of time. I just want to say, first and foremost, thank you so, so much for taking the time out of your busy schedule to come and talk to us both. It's been really, really incredible. We've really enjoyed it.
Thank you so much. I love talking to you guys. Take care. Thanks a lot. Bye.
All the best.
Bye-bye. Thanks. Bye.
Bye-bye.